Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm sitting not in Roberta's in Williamsburg, but actually looking at the Golden Gate Bridge at the Presidio in San Francisco with one of my favorite chefs in the world, Tracy Desjardins, who's just added yet another restaurant to her constellation, the Commissary here at the Presidio. For those of you who might not know Tracy as well as I do, let me give you a little bit of her background. She really hit the American scene when, in 1995, she was the rising star chef at James Beard and Best New Chef. In 2007, she got the James Beard Foundation Best Chef of the Pacific Region. Her restaurants have been called the best new restaurant by Esquire. In 7x7, San Francisco's Most Fascinating People in 2014. She was a finalist on Top Chef Masters, and this I love, she beat Mario Batali on Iron Chef. She is one of the most dynamic, important chefs we have in the United States today, and so I'm really, really privileged and honored and happy that you're with us today. Welcome, Tracy.
Thanks, Dorothy. Great to see you. Great to be talking to you this morning.
Okay, so for all our friends out there, I'm going to talk to you first about your upbringing. And I think a lot of people know you have a Mexican heritage background because of the food that you do. But in my research, I see you're also French Acadian.
Yes.
Well, so tell us where you grew up, how you grew up, how are all those influences, and how you got to be Tracy Desjardins.
Okay. I'll do my best. Right. I grew up in a small town. The name of the town is Firebaugh. And if you went through there, you would sort of look at it and say, you know, how did you become who you are today? And I guess that's my story. My grandparents were born in Mexico and immigrated here. My grandfather when he was about 20, and my grandmother when she was quite young, about 5. And so I grew up in a town that was very influenced by, you know, Mexicans and that population of people, a lot of farm workers, and then a small population of you know, farmers and farm owners. And that was sort of my dad's side of things. And he his father was born in Louisiana.
Ooh.
So he was Cajun.
Cajun.
He was a Cajun.
Oh.
And his mother was Norwegian and Swedish and grew up in the Pacific Northwest. So she was like this amazing baker. And my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was this, he'd grown up on the bayous. And so his passion was all about seafood. He literally used to drive from the valley over to the coast in Santa Cruz and fill his car full of fresh seafood and drive back to the valley. And at that point in time, I mean, it took, you know, probably, you know, 10 hours round trip. you know, because the cars weren't very fast and so on and so forth. But he was so into food that that was just, you know, what he wanted to do and what he was about. So I grew up with food all around me. All my grandparents cooked, and everybody in my family cooked, and food was central to what we did. And my dad is a farmer, so I grew up...
Still?
He retired about 5 years ago.
But all your life?
All of my life.
So you grew up on a farm?
I did, in a small town, but, you know, spent a lot of time out on the farm. And it was more agribusiness. It wasn't a cute little, you know, fabulous organic farm. I wish I could say it was. You know, if we mentioned organics at the kitchen table, it was usually a big, you know, fight. So, you know, he's kind of come full circle and learned the value of it. But, yeah, I grew up in, you know, a small town that was kind of about agribusiness. He farmed cotton, sugar beets, and rice. So he was a rice farmer. So I grew up eating rice every meal. It was California short grain Japanese rice, that was, you know, my life.
So when you were in the fifth grade, mm-hmm. what did you want to be?
So up until the time I was 16, and from the time I was about five, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I was really into animals. I was passionate about horses and always had, you know, a million cats and dogs and was always rescuing animals that I found, you know, who were abandoned. And it was my passion as a kid was always that. And I really, that was my path. Graduated from high school a year early and went to UC Santa Cruz with the intention of studying a pre-med program and going on to vet school. I was young, and it was a little too much. And so,
16 is very young, especially if we put it in a college atmosphere.
Yeah, I was way too young. But, you know, when I was in high school, I started cooking and baking when I was probably about four. It was maybe even three.
Now, who is showing you how to bake?
My mom. So when my older brother, I have a brother who's 2 years older than I am. When he went off to school, I was, you know, very sad to see him go. And I was three. And so my mom started, you know, baking with me to keep me occupied. And so, you know, I think by the time I was, I don't know, four, I could make chocolate chip cookies on my own. I couldn't deal with the oven. But I was, you know, I was a pretty avid baker. And that kind of segued into, in high school, being more of a hobbyist cook. And so I had a subscription to Bon Appetit and Gourmet and, you know, pored over those recipes. And I would, as soon as I had my driver's license, I would drive to Fresno to find ingredients for, you know, recipes. And I really started to cook pretty elaborate meals. And that was my thing. You know, it was my hobby. And so when I went to college at 16 and dropped out within the first year, I was also an avid skier. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna become a ski bum. And my parents weren't so keen on that. So I thought, okay, well, I'll be a cook and I'll support myself cooking and ski.
In Colorado, or
I didn't know. I mean, this was just this is
you're
a 16-year-old
ski resort.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I'm, you know, a 16-year-old, you know, kind of lost and trying to figure out my path. And you know, my parents weren't too keen, you know, on what I was, you know, that I was dropping out of school. And so I started looking at culinary schools. And at that point in time, this is a little known fact. I applied to the California Culinary Academy, which was on Fremont Street in San Francisco, and they turned me down. I didn't have any practical experience, and they had pretty serious criteria at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so they said no, and so I started trying to figure out, okay, you know, how can I learn how to cook? Well, I was fortunate. I had an aunt and uncle who were avid gourmets and used to travel in France to three-star Michelin restaurants. They would go on these 10-day trips, and they would go to, you know, two- and three-star Michelin restaurants, lunch and dinner. And they had met Joachim Splichal at the Hotel Negresco in Nice and had become friends with him because he had just moved to Los Angeles and they lived in L.A., and so they connected with Joachim and said, you know, I have this niece and she wants to learn to cook. What should she do? And he said she should come and work for me. And, you know, I'll give her a trial. You know, I had no experience, no formal cooking experience whatsoever. Said, I'll give her 2 weeks. And if she can, you know, she can prove herself, then, you know, I'll keep her for a couple of years and then I'll send her off to France. So that... So that was the plan. I started in the kitchen with Joachim with absolutely no formal kitchen knowledge. And he was a cutting edge chef. Amazing.
What did he put you through in those first 2 weeks? How was he testing you?
Well, I mean, it was basic skills. I started out at the bottom as a garde-manger, apprentice.
Was he looking for you? Could you stand on your feet that long? Were you a whiner? What do you think he was looking at in those first 2 weeks? Because he wouldn't expect you to have skills.
No, he wouldn't expect me to have skills. I think you can tell pretty quickly. I mean, I put people through the test that in the same way, and you can kind of see how somebody thinks and figure out pretty quickly whether they kind of have a natural aptitude. And I think that's what he was looking for. He was looking for a natural aptitude. So,
well, can you expand on that? What are the telltale signs of that?
I think it's organization. I mean, I think it's sort of how you sequence and how you think about, approaching a task and also your wherewithal. How tough are you? And he scared me to death. I mean, he was a screamer. He was super intense, and I cry at the drop of a hat. So I remember going and hiding in the bathroom and saying, "Okay, pull it together." Like, the worst thing you could do is cry. You're going to have to just keep it together and, put on a steely exterior and try to be tough.
What year was this?
1983.
Or how many women in the kitchen?
Well, I was fortunate because Joachim was actually a really big advocate of women in the kitchen. And one of his sous chefs, who was the chef poissonnier, she was this young woman who had worked in Napa and, kind of took me under her wing right away. Uh-huh. The kitchen was comprised mostly of Americans, so really incredibly talented group of people. Pastry chef Gerhard Meekler, he was this German guy who has a place here in San Francisco now, who was amazing. We had an amazing team, and it was really hard, but I didn't feel discriminated against. And Joachim saw something in me right away that he was willing to foster and teach. And I mean, he didn't cut me any slack, but he was certainly encouraging. I mean, after 3 days of watching me, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask him what he saw. I could guess, but there were about, I think, five of us that he sort of took on the same basis, and two of us got to stay, and the others were cut. At five or six of us, I can't remember, but there was a group of us who were all kind of green, to varying degrees, and he chose two of us to stay on.
So how long did you stay with him?
So I stayed with him until 1986.
So 3 years?
Yeah, so 3 years, 2.5 years. And the first restaurant was about, it didn't last very long. He ended up quitting, and so then we opened another restaurant, and I got to go through that whole process, which was a very big endeavor in Beverly Hills called Maxo Triangle. The first restaurant was called 7th Street Bistro. And so he kind of ran me through each of the stations in a traditional apprenticeship. I started out in garde-manger, and then I went to poissonnier, and then on to the meat station. I didn't do pastry. I had gone to France to dine with my family there, and went to Trois Gros and met Michel, and he agreed to take me on as an apprentice.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
In France, yeah. Taking a girl, woman.
Yes.
How did that happen? This didn't happen. This is 1986, 86?
1986, yeah.
This didn't happen then, everybody.
No.
So, I mean, Tracy, this is huge.
Yeah.
You're just eating there and say, I want to work here?
Well, my aunt and uncle had become friends with the Trois Gros because they were frequent guests. And, my uncle, he became a bit of a mentor in terms of directing, what he thought I should do. So I sort of had him, and then I had Joachim, and, between the two of them, they sort of had this vision. And, at that point in time, we didn't have restaurants like the French Laundry here. So if you wanted to learn about that type of cuisine, you had to go to France. I mean, that was where you were going. That was it. And so I was, you know, and I was very naive. I mean, I had never left California. I was this little, you know, country farm girl. I was not, you know, a terribly sophisticated person. And I think, I don't know, I just never really thought about the obstacles, you know? I mean, that's one of the things I always say. You know, when particularly young women say, you know, well, how did you do it? And weren't you discriminated against? And, you know, I never thought about that part of it. You know, I didn't think, I thought about what was possible, not what was not possible. Mm-hmm. And it just, I was so inspired by you know, what I was doing and the opportunity to learn and to work in a kitchen like Trois Gros. I went there as a guest and I saw that kitchen and, you know, you can feel the history and, you know, understand, you know, the history of a restaurant like that. And it was, you know, there was just no other way I was going to do this. I mean, this was the path. And, you know, anything I had to do to make it happen was my course.
So did you speak French?
I did not speak French.
So what were the first days? Like, were you sitting there and then the next day you're in the kitchen?
Or? Yeah, I mean, no. So my aunt, who was, you know, wonderful, said, you know, let's go to Paris. We'll spend, you know, 2 months taking French classes before you start at Trois Gros. I started taking classes. I mean, as soon as I sort of had this aspiration in Los Angeles, I started taking classes at Alliance Française, but I was working, you know, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, so I didn't have a lot of time to study French. You know, all the culinary terms were there.
And the curse words.
Yeah, exactly.
In the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I mean, kitchen language, you know, all the technical sort of kitchen stuff was all in French anyway, so understanding that, you know, you have a pretty good leg up. And, you know, honestly, not knowing French was probably a benefit because then I didn't hear all the static. You know, it was critical path. I mean, you know, understanding what I needed to understand in terms, I mean, if someone puts a big box of, you know, mushrooms in front of you and shows you how to clean one and, you know, you carry on. So you don't need a ton of language when you're cooking at that level. You know, I was an apprentice. I was doing the, you know, crappy jobs.
Right.
So
how long did you stay at Trois Gros?
I was there for 6 months. Yeah.
And what did you learn there that you don't think you could have learned in the United States at that time?
I think that, you know, first off, I mean, working in a legendary restaurant like that, I mean, just the history, the respect of generation to generation. The restaurant at that point was run by Pierre and Michel. Jean passed away. I think he passed away the year I started cooking. I remember reading that. And so it was Pierre and Michel. And just being in a kitchen like that, I think the reverence that the French people had for cuisine was one of the things that really struck me. That restaurant was a very interesting mix in that at that point in time it wasn't, of course it was a 3-star Michelin and it was very fancy, but it was also accessible to country people. And you would see these people who would come in. The bar was still sort of a gathering place for farmers, for people, foragers, for people who lived in the area. And they would come in and have a drink in the bar and not necessarily eat in the restaurant, but they would gather there. And you could see that there were people that would come to eat there that saved up for God knows how long, a year, 5 years, their whole lives. But their reverence for that kind of cuisine and what that meant to them was, you know, amazing. It wasn't just wealthy people who could afford to eat there. It was people who... It was deeply meaningful. It was almost like a pilgrimage to cuisine.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, you don't, it's hard to understand that kind of thing if you don't see it in front of your eyes.
And did you learn any techniques that you thought were extraordinary or was it just...
Well, I mean, I remember certain things that would happen. Like we would get, you know, we would get the fish deliveries twice a week from Brittany. And so, you know, you'd get these, all this product, the oysters and the lobsters, and they were coming, you know, directly from the people who were sourcing them. So the way that the product was procured was really interesting. I mean, foie gras would come once a week, and we're talking about, you know, I mean, hundreds of pounds of it. So, you know, seeing these products on that scale, hunters that would come in with, you know, birds that they had killed, and mushroom foragers coming in with mushrooms that they had found in the woods. And, you know, the parking lot was down below the kitchen. You could see out, and so you'd see these people, the trucks pulling in, small trucks pulling in, and people bringing their wares into the kitchen. And so it just, you know, it's a piece of sort of history and procurement and, you know, part of the French culture that you just couldn't get any other way. So, yes, there were culinary things as well, but to me the takeaway was understanding the history of a kitchen like that and the generational, you know, and then also the people that I worked with, which there were a lot of young men that were heirs to kitchens like Trois Gros, who, you know, were going to take on the family's one-star or two-star or three-star Michelin restaurant. And they were doing their apprenticeship in France to learn their trade, even though their legacy was to take over their father's kitchen. So it just, you know, it was incredible in that sense.
And it was one of the cathedrals that you
So
pilgrimage to being a chef.
Yeah.
So how long did you stay in France?
So I stayed, that time I was there for almost a year.
So where'd you go after Trois Gros?
I traveled around a little bit, and I also got to, that was my second time, I think. Let me think. So I only worked at Trois Gros that time, and then I moved back to the States, out of money. So I didn't get paid while I was there, and came back to New York and worked for a year and a half in New York.
Where?
So I worked for Drew Nieuport at Montrachet in New York.
So was it easier to get a job in New York because you had been in France, do you think? Or how? And what was the atmosphere for a woman back then to get into a kitchen?
Well, here's the story. There were a couple of things that happened. While I was at Trois Gros, I got a call one night from Joachim, and he said, you know, I'm going to open a new restaurant in Los Angeles. So he had finished with the restaurant in Beverly Hills and said, I'm going to open my own place, and I want you to be the chef de cuisine. So, you know, stay doing what you're doing right now, and, you know, when we're ready, you know, come back and
wanted you to be the chef de cuisine.
He wanted me to be the chef de cuisine.
Wow.
So
Joachim.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I'm impressed. How old were you?
I was 20.
20?
Yeah. I mean, at the point at which he called me, I was 20.
20?
Yeah, I was 20.
Oh, Tracy.
Yeah.
My gosh, I knew you were brilliant, though. Wow. Child protege.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a lot of grit.
So go on.
Yeah. So I went back to New York, and I remember, and this is probably, I mean, if I have any regret in sort of the trajectory of my career, I interviewed with Danielle Boulou, and you know, sat down, and what I'd worked with Joachim had worked for Danielle, so I knew of his status. And at this point, he was at
Plaza TV.
I think it was Le Cirque.
Oh, Le Cirque.
Yeah, I think it was Le Cirque.
Oh, in the 90s.
Yeah, this was 87 at this point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think he was just starting at Le Cirque. I think he just finished at La Paz Atene, if I'm not mistaken, but I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
I interviewed with him, and he offered me a job, but he asked me for a 2-year commitment. And I had already committed to Joachim, and so I couldn't absolutely say without a doubt that I was going to be available to him for 2 years. And so I said, I can't give you that commitment. And so he didn't give me the job. And
did you tell him why?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he knew why. You know, but that was just, you know, that was his criteria. And I took it very seriously. I mean, today, that would mean nothing to someone. They would say, yeah, sure, of course. And, you know.
You wouldn't do that today. You still would.
I wouldn't do that today. Yeah. No, no. But it's, you know, it just, that was my orientation in the world was very, you know, serious. It's like, I'll tell you 2 years, it's going to be 2 years, and I can't do that.
And it's not a good thing to do today.
No.
Because once you break your word with one chef, this is a very small community.
Absolutely.
You know, you've ruined your reputation there.
Yeah. And, you know, if you really want to learn, you know, everything about a chef, that's it's a good amount of time. It's the right amount of time if you're early in your career.
Yeah.
And I was. So I interviewed with Drew Nieuport. Brian Whitmer was the chef at Montrachet at that point in time. He was just on his way out, and so I was working for Drew when Deborah Ponczak took over.
Uh-huh.
And so this was my first time working for a female chef, which you know, was...
Was it different?
It was different. I think it was more collaborative. You know, Deborah and I had a great working relationship. She really relied on me for, you know, a lot. And I was her sous chef and, you know, an integral part of the foundation of that kitchen. And I never felt like she was trying to keep me in my place. She was utilizing me in every way possible.
Nice.
And, you know, it was a really great experience. And I did everything. And, you know, it was my first foray into an American kitchen, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Drew is an American. And even though the restaurant was called Montrachet and it was pretty, you know, on the French side, it wasn't the same kind of kitchen that I had been in up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, my first foray into a little bit different style.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I went back to France. I stayed a year and a half with Drew. And, you know, one day I was like, okay, well, the restaurant in LA is still not open. And I've kind of had it with New York. And I had the opportunity, again, through my uncle, to go and work at Le Petit Carton.
Oh, with Saint-Germain.
Oh. Yeah. And I had eaten at Akistrat when he was still there. And, you know, I thought his food was just absolutely brilliant. And I had, you know, an opportunity to go and work at another 3-star Michelin restaurant.
And how different was it from Tuaco?
You know, it was the city. And it was, and Saint-Germain was less hands-on. He had a chef de cuisine, Bertrand, who was running the kitchen. He would come through, but he wasn't, you know, in the kitchen on a day-to-day basis, which at Trois Gros, Pierre and Michel were there running the kitchen every day. So it was, you know, a little bit of a shift culturally. And it was Paris. It was on the Place de la Madeleine.
Where'd you live?
I lived in the Premier near Les Halles.
Did you ever have time off to enjoy Paris?
Well, you know, Parisian restaurants are closed on Saturdays and Sundays. So, you know, it was Monday through Friday and the hours were long. You'd get a break in the afternoon, but basically you'd work from 8 in the morning until about 3 o'clock. And then you'd come back at 5 and work until 12 or 1. So it was, you know, split shifts and 5 days a week. So you were exhausted at the end of the week, no question. It was, you spent all your time, and, you know, it wasn't enough time in between to get back to my apartment. And, I mean, sometimes I would go if I was totally exhausted and take a quick nap. Mm. But, you know, it was long hours. So I did another about 6-month stint at Le Petit Carton, and it was extraordinary. I think, you know, his cuisine was much more ethnically influenced, I think, than, I mean, Trois Gros was straight up French, but Saint-Germain was very intrigued by spices and, you know, flavors from other parts of the world, and so it was a different exposure, very different style of cuisine. So recipes were very complex, lots of layering of spices, and very, very
so it's like
different.
It's almost a graduate school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you spend a year there?
No, I wish. That was, you know, they would only take you for small increments at that point in time. High demand for those kinds of stages. I wish that I could have spent more time.
So where'd you go after that?
So after that, I had befriended or you know, gotten to know Alain Passard at Arpège.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, eating there a couple times, and I met him as a diner and asked him when I finished it at Le Petit Carton if I could come and spend a few weeks in the kitchen. So I spent 3 weeks with him at Arpège. And then went to Louis XV and worked for Alain Ducasse.
In Monte Carlo.
In Monte Carlo, yes, when that was his only restaurant.
Whoa.
So I did 3 weeks there. So amazing, you know. I mean, just...
Talk about knowing how to source vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and Ducasse.
Between Passard.
Yeah, yeah. And they were in the kitchen every day. I mean, they, you know, it was Ducasse's only restaurant at that point in time. And now we're talking about 1988, 89.
How many American women chefs were able? I know Judy Rogers was at
Yeah, Judy worked at Trois Girls, but she was there as an exchange student.
Oh, so it wasn't as a staff.
Well, she ended up going back and working in the kitchen there. But her introduction to the family was as a family member. She worked. She lived with Jean as an exchange student, and I think she was. I think she was around 16 when she was there. But
with you, how many when you were there? How many?
Didn't see any. Zero. Not only American women, but no women.
So,
I worked in four kitchens over, you know, a period of basically a year and a half, and there was not another woman in any of the kitchens.
Do you feel that you had any particular challenges, or just straight up, it's hard for everybody?
I mean, I had to ignore a lot of crap, you know? I mean, it's, you know, your orientation. Do you want to focus on the positive or the negative? And I was there for a reason, and I'm not going to say it was easy.
Yeah.
It was far from easy. It was, you know, I can remember, you know, calling my parents when I lived in Rouen and Trois Gros and just, you know, crying. I had cut my finger and I wasn't supposed to be in the kitchen, so they had to pretend like I was a client and take me to the hospital, and I had my finger sewed up and they didn't use anesthesia, and it was like, I was just like, I lost it that night.
And
I called my mother and she's like, go honey, come home. My dad got on the phone, he's like, don't you come home. You stay there. You know, you finish what you started. So I had my moments. You know, it was definitely not easy.
So we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be back in a minute.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Talking to Tracy Desjardins, and we've just gone through Europe with her, and oh my gosh, you have such an interesting background. No wonder you're the chef you are today. So tell us, how did you start your own restaurants? Give us just a very quick, jumping from France back here, what did it take to start your own restaurant? Would you know how many other restaurants?
So I'll go through that part very quickly. I came back and opened Patina in Los Angeles with Joachim as his chef de cuisine in 1989, and so I spent 2 years running his kitchen, and moved to San Francisco in 91. All throughout my time, I always knew San Francisco was where I wanted to land, and so I moved up here in 91 and started to get the lay of the land. I didn't want to take a chef's position right away, so I opened Aqua with George Marone in 1991 as a kitchen manager, and got to know purveyors and, you know, the lay of the land here in San Francisco and what San Francisco restaurants were about. And then worked at a restaurant called Elka in 1992.
Oh, I remember Elka.
Yeah. And that was, you know, a great experience. I worked with Elka collaboratively to create all the food for that restaurant. It was Japanese, French, fantastic, really amazing. And then in 93, I got to open Rubicon with Drew Neoporant. And I was the executive chef there, not my own restaurant, but for all intents and purposes, it felt like my own. I was an integral part of everything that happened there and the opening, and treated it as my own. So I did that for 3 years. That's where I won the 95 and, Food and Wine Best New Chefs. And then I had the opportunity in 1997 to open Jardiniere with Pat Coletto. So that was the start of my role as a chef owner and having my own place.
Right. So I've read that you credit Pat with really kind of being your business school mentor.
Yeah.
So how does a chef, you know, your cooking creds are beyond, you know, question and vaulted. So how does the chef in you then bridge over to be chef owner? What's the difference?
You know, it's a fiscal responsibility of running a business. And, you know, I opened with Pat as my business partner, but I was the day-to-day operator. And so I really needed to learn the ins and outs of, you know, what the financial picture looks like. Because if you're going to own your own business, you better understand what a P&L means. It's, you know, unless you have endless sources of funds, you know, you can lose a lot of money very quickly if you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
And so that was the beginning of my education around what dollars and cents meant and how to run your own business and what that means.
Did anything change in you when you became part of, you know, or owner of your own restaurant? Did your sensibilities in any way change?
I don't think so. I mean, I always had a very, you know, thrifty management style. I mean, I think Joachim went through a couple of really tough experiences that I was privy to in watching him prior to opening Patina. He lost a couple of restaurants, and so that was part of my early education, and I knew what that looked like. So there was that conscientiousness around making things work financially that was very much on my radar. So that was always my orientation, even when I was working for someone else. It was, I wanted to make everything perform to the best of my ability, and was very conscientious.
So when you had Jardinier, and now it's yours, what was your vision? What was it that was burning inside you to do in a restaurant when it was finally yours?
You know, you learn so much, you know, through your experiences of things you want to do and things you don't want to do around probably more management style, you know, and back in the days that I came through, you know, those French kitchens, they were really rough, you know. There was not a lot of, you know, soft-talking, you know, supportive management style. It was all pretty hardcore. And, you know, there's another way to do it. I mean, it's kitchens have to be disciplined. They have to be strict. And I believe that to this day. But I think the results that you can get, there are different ways that you can get to that point and make sure that you have those standards that are upheld and the food is executed the way you want. It doesn't have to be through tyranny and intimidation.
Enlightened management.
Yes, exactly.
Enlightened management. So then you've actually grown. You have, I think, a small empire. You've got Jardinier, you have Public House, Mojita Cucina, and now the Commissary, you have a catering company.
And Arguello, which is our latest Mexican restaurant here in the Presidio.
In the Presidio.
Yeah.
So how many people work for you now?
Well, the two that I own outright are Mojita and the Ferry Building and Jardinier. Those I own, chef owner. So between those two restaurants, I have a little over 100 employees. So not huge. And then the others are actually management contracts where I'm, you know, a consulting partner. And they're employed by, you know, bigger companies.
So how much time do you spend being a chef? And how much time do you spend being a manager?
Yeah, it ebbs and flows. When I open a new restaurant, I will immerse and locate myself in the kitchen for, you know, X period of time getting a restaurant open. So at the Commissary, you know, the first, say, 3 months, I was in the kitchen every day in whites with a knife in my hand cooking, which is, you know, my greatest pleasure. You know, it, as an owner, as a business owner, as somebody who manages, you know, all of these different restaurants, unfortunately, you get pulled very far away from the kitchen. So it's lovely to be able to do that, and I wish that I could do it all the time. But I would say, you know, 20% of my time now is a chef, and, you know, 80% is dealing with the business enterprise.
Well, we're going to have to take another little break here, and when we come back, I really want to get into where's your head today and what's exciting for you tomorrow. We'll be right back. Chef's
Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, sitting in the Presidio in San Francisco, near the Commissary, which is Tracy Desjardins' new venture. And we're talking about where she is today, what her vision is. Her background is second to none. It's the most stellar sort of schooling anyone could have in the restaurants she worked in. So where does someone this talented and this successful and so young, what's tomorrow like? What's today like for you? Because you're a working mother as well.
Yes, I am. Yes. A 14-year-old son. Yeah.
Right. So where is the constellation, the next constellation for Tracy?
I took some time. I took my foot off the pedal, as I like to say, when my son was young, because I didn't want to miss those precious years. And not to say that I wasn't still doing what I do. I just wasn't doing it to the degree that I had done previously. And so, you know, he's not completely grown up, but he's 3 years, 4 years away from going to college and you know, starting his own life. And so I've returned to working again, you know, opening these two restaurants in the last 6 months. I've worked really, really hard and been working those long, long hours again. And I'm really enjoying it. I mean, I still love what I do, and I love, you know, being in the restaurants at night and talking to guests and working with young chefs and doing what I do. So it's progression is not necessarily to work less. I mean, I feel like I still have a good 10 years in me to, you know, to work really, really hard and to continue to do what I've been doing, you know, opening restaurants and creating new concepts and working with my managers and teaching and mentoring them. That's kind of what today looks like. I'm not sure, you know, I don't have an exact path for the next 10 years, but I've been opening new restaurants. I still have some more work to do here in the Presidio. We have a couple of little projects that are happening.
So tell me about a dish that you've created recently for one of your restaurants that, I mean, you have such sophistication, such knowledge, and such background. What is a dish that really excited you that you've created recently?
Well, I've been delving more into Mexican cooking, honestly. You know, I grew up, Mexican cooking is very regional. And so, you know, the dishes that I grew up with were reflective of where my grandparents came from in Mexico. But I try to travel in Mexico as much as I can. And I have been, I've never learned about cooking by looking at books or reading recipes or history. But Mexican cooking has really grabbed me, and I'm just fascinated by it. I think it is the most underrated cuisine in the world. I think we haven't even begun to hit the tip of the iceberg on what is out there. People don't know it. It's inaccessible because it happens in people's homes, and it's part of history, and it's not necessarily in restaurants, and people are afraid to eat in Mexico. So I think that there's just this, you know, I got to know Diana Kennedy a little bit over the last 5 years, and she's just the most incredible woman. If I could take back the 32 years I've been in this industry, I'd go back and attach myself at the hip to Diana and learn everything I could about Mexican cooking. I just am completely enthralled. So that's kind of where my head is right now in learning more about, you know, deep Mexico and historical recipes and that kind of thing. So
What was your son's favorite food growing up that he loved you to make?
So, God, you know, he eats everything. I never have fed my son like a child. He's always eaten from the time he was a baby. I had one of those little food grinders, and I would grind up what we were eating, and that's what he ate. So he's a really adventuresome eater, has a great palate. He's like a little budding food critic. It's so funny what they learn. I mean, he can see details just... You know, we go to a new restaurant, he's like, wow, they really need to work.
Well, it's in his blood, right?
Completely. Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, young women in the kitchen are almost afraid to have children. You know, I was at a cherry bomb conference, and, you know, it was a very big topic. How hard is it to raise a child and be a woman chef?
Well, I think it's very hard. I had a plan. You know, I started cooking professionally when I was 17 years old, and I figured out pretty quickly that really, like, balance wasn't really an option. I mean, there's balance in what we do is really hard to achieve. And so I had a goal in mind that I would be in a position by the time I was 34, which I thought was the right time to have a kid, and that I would have myself established enough in my career that I would be able to do that. And that's exactly what I did. So I had a plan looking forward to get to that point, to be financially in a position, to be in have enough autonomy to make those choices, to really hit that goal where I would position myself to be able to do that. And it's exactly what I did. So 34 was when Eli was born, and, you know, I owned my own restaurant at that point in time, so I had choices. Mm-hmm. I had established myself already in my career. I think it's very difficult. I mean, I see lots of young women who come through my kitchens who, at the point at which they decide to have a child, they never come back to the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Motherhood is enthralling, and, you know, it's a child is a tough competition for getting back and working a lot. I mean, I think, you know, it's a problem for women in general. Yes. Do they make that choice to go back into the workforce after they've had kids?
Yes. I think it is generic across the board.
Yeah.
Of, you know, if you're in a high-powered job that is not 9-to-5,
right,
and not so controllable, it's hard. But in the, especially the hours.
Yeah, but for some, you know, in some ways, being a chef, because, you know, generally chefs work at night. You know, you do kind of have some. You have a little bit of, you can
leeway,
juggle a little bit more, a little
day.
Leeway. Yeah. So
that's really, yeah, really good. So there's, as I was telling you before, a lot of young chefs listen to this show. And if you had any words of wisdom, because we're going to have to wind up here in a little bit, words of wisdom for the next generation or the young chefs that you see coming into your kitchen, what do you want to say to them?
It's an easy one. I think that the thing that has happened that has surprised me the most in the trajectory of my career has been the celebrity of chefs in the last, 15 years. It's, you know, people think of us as celebrities, and lots of chefs are on TV, and, you know, it changes the way people see you when they see you on TV. If you get into this business because you want to be a celebrity chef, you're getting into it for the wrong reasons. I mean, you really have to have a passion for cooking and for working in restaurants and for giving, you know, the guest experience to the diner, which is, you know, what I'm working for all the time, is to create an experience for the people who come to my restaurants. And I think that that's really what it's all about. I mean, there are other aspects of it, for sure. I mean, there are other things that you can get into around sustainability or, you know, whatever your passion is. But it's a hard road, and it's not glamorous, and it's very hard work. And there's no easy path. I think that if you're really going to do it right, you have to put in the hours, and you have to have the dedication and the passion for what we do. And that's the reason to get into the business.
Amen. Amen. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Yeah.
Such a beautiful place. And, you know, best of luck with all of these endeavors. And you're going to be cooking at the expo.
Yeah, I can't wait.
You,
it's fantastic.
Mary, really good. So thanks a lot, Tracy.
Thank you, Dorothy. Great to see you.
Great to see you, too. And thanks to my producers, Robin Cohen and Jack Innes. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.